It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The Southern Poverty Law Center, or the SPLC, who made their money suing the KKK, were set up to defend people like me. But now they become the monster that they claim they wanted to defeat. They have named me, alongside Ayaan Hirsi Ali, on a list of anti-Muslim extremists. Growing up, I was attacked by far-right racists. In my 10 years countering extremism, I've been attacked countless times by religious fanatics. But I never thought factions on the left, who were meant to fight for the rights of people like me, would try to silence my voice. It is clear now that liberal, reforming Muslims and ex-Muslims are under attack from all sides. The populist extreme anti-Muslim crowd because of our skin color and heritage. The Islamist extremists because we challenge their theocratic views. And now this, betrayed by those on the left. Placing my name on a list like this not only smears my name, but also puts me in physical danger. As we have seen of late, the left have descended into violence, whether that's punching people on the street, throwing explosives and attacking people in protests and riots, or assassination attempts on right-wing politicians by leftist fans of the SPLC. The SPLC have a wealth of funds and a team of lawyers, but we have a movement.
That was the voice of Majid Nawaz, who is a former Muslim extremist. Now, he is a Muslim, but he's a former extremist, and he's spoken out in Britain and in Europe very clearly about this. You heard him talk about it just a little bit a few minutes ago. He's actually talked about these gang-raping groups and criticized them, which has been a big story in Europe, for sure, and an issue over which the Germans and, of course, the British have not defended their own people and their own young girls over. But Majid Nawaz has spoken out about it. You just heard him explain that he, along with many of us, I might say, the American Family Association, the Family Research Council, and some of us as individuals, have been identified by the Southern Poverty Law Center as hate groups, haters, targeted, placed in jeopardy, in danger over the years. We've talked about this before, but this is the big story of the week in this regard. This is the story. The Southern Poverty Law Center reached a settlement with Majid Nawaz, a $3.3 million, and issued an apology to him. From Richard Cohen, who's the president of the SPLC currently. Mr. Nawaz and Quilliam, that's Mr. Nawaz's organization in Britain, have made valuable and important contributions to public discourse, including by promoting pluralism and condemning both anti-Muslim bigotry and Islamic terror extremism. That's just part of their statement. But the bottom line is the Southern Poverty Law Center, for the first time that I know of, has actually been held to account successfully by someone identified by them as a hater. We want to talk about the SPLC today because it's been a while since we spoke about it. We want to talk about this story, and we also want to expand what's happened since we last spoke. Because when we last spoke, the FBI, the Department of Defense, and other organizations, and now more, are using the Southern Poverty Law Center as their expert guide to extremists and haters. That's their terms, not mine, in this country. James Simpson is really one of the nation's leading experts on this. James is an investigative journalist. He's a businessman and an author. His most recent book is The Red-Green Axis, Refugees, Immigration, and the Agenda to Erase America. He writes for so many different outlets, including Accuracy in Media, Breitbart, Washington Times, American Thinker, and I could go on and on, Daily Caller. There's so many. He's recently written a report on the Southern Poverty Law Center, which we're going to make available on our Facebook page, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So, Jim, thanks for joining me this morning.
Hey, Sandy. Great to be with you.
Before we jump into the general discussion about the SPLC, let's talk about this case settled with Majid Nawaz. I'm really curious to know what your thoughts are about this.
Well, to me, it is... a demonstration of just how absurd the SPLC's targeting ideas are. You know, Nawaz is somebody, one of the few people who at least claims to be trying to reform Islam away from, you know, the radical Islam that we've come to know and be very concerned about in this country, in Europe, and in the Middle East. You know, there's debate about his objectives there, but he certainly doesn't warrant being called an anti-Muslim extremist. And it's just typical of what the SPLC does. I mean, if you disagree with the SPLC, you are an extremist of one form or another. And the thing about it is that, you know, it has little, if any, basis in reality. And they don't even claim that it does. You know, they talk about opposing people based on their ideology. I quote spokesman Mark Potok, one probably the most well-known face of the Southern Poverty Law Center, as saying, when we name groups hate groups, it has nothing to do with any allegation of criminality or measure of expected violence. It's purely about ideology. So they say it themselves. And they are on the extreme end of the leftist continuum. They are hard leftists. And that, more than anything else, fully explains how and why they go after other people who don't share their extreme ideology. And, hey, and that's all you have to know about them, really.
Yeah.
There's little more.
Let me, in regard to this particular case out of Britain, one thing that's interesting that shows that their apology is less than sincere about trying to get this right and, oh, we're sorry and we were wrong about him,
is
that one other notable person on their hate list, there are many, but Ayan Ali Hirsi, the former Muslim from the Netherlands. Tell us about her. She's on that list, and I noticed they did not remove her name. They didn't pay her any money. They still have her on the list. Tell us about her, just to illustrate how absurd this is.
Yeah, it's absolutely absurd. You know, she was a member of the Dutch Parliament, and she was a friend of filmmaker Theo van Gogh, you know, a descendant of the famous artist. And he was murdered by a Muslim in the streets, and her name was pinned to his body with a knife, saying that we're going to come after you, too. And how is she a hater? How is she a hater? But she remains on the list, despite the fact that her life has been threatened by people who really do hate. And, you know, the same thing is true of the Family Research Council. And, you know, they're soft-pedaling the story about how the Family Research Council was attacked in 2012 by Floyd Corkins, a homosexual activist. They claim he barged in and shot a guard, and his goal was to send a message to the Family Research Council. No, what he said when he was interviewed by the police was that his goal was to murder as many people in the Family Research Council as he could, and then go on to other organizations and try to do the same thing. So they even soft-pedal the truth about that. And the Family Research Council, which is a mainstream conservative Christian organization, remains on the hate list despite that. And Floyd Corkins acknowledged that he was inspired by the Southern Poverty Law Center based on their listing the FRC as a hate group.
And, you know, Jim, another story similar, and in some ways worse, is the story of the shooter a little bit more than a year ago in Alexandria. Yep. The gentleman who nearly killed Steve Scalise. Talk about that for a second.
Yep. Far-left Democrat activist who was inspired, once again, by the Southern Poverty Law Center's hate list to go to Alexandria, Virginia, stake out that baseball field for 3 weeks, and when they finally showed up, he walked onto the field and asked one of the departing members of Congress, I forget who it was, if
Mo
these
Brooks.
Were all... Sorry?
It was Mo Brooks, Alabama.
Mel Brooks. Mo Brooks.
Mo Brooks,
yeah, sorry. And he asked them if they were Republicans, and Mo innocently said yes, whereupon he pulled out his semi-automatic firearm and began shooting at people. And fortunately, nobody except him was killed, but he almost killed House Majority Whip Steve Scalise. And he's still recovering from those injuries.
Yes, and I would argue that hardly anyone knows, except those that listen to American Family Radio and maybe those that heard Tony Perkins with Megyn Kelly right after it happened, understand mm-hmm. that these shootings, these near mass killings, both of them,
yep.
Took place as a result of some person checking the Southern Poverty Law Center's hate list and then acting
yep.
out on it. And that's why,
yep.
honestly, to be honest with you, I'm surprised that more groups have not sued the Southern Poverty Law Center. Now, other Christian groups, at least one other has, right?
Yeah, oh, of course. It was James Kennedy's Coral Ridge Ministries. They're suing the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, they have been sued because of their stand on homosexuality and gay marriage, and that's probably why they've targeted the American Family Association. But they have kind of some hobby horses, Jim. They are both, you know, they are all out advocates for anything that is connected to the LGBT community, anything
Absolutely.
That's connected to radical Islam, and what else?
Oh, just about any extreme left agenda that you can think of. You have to think, when you think of the Southern Poverty Law Centers, basically it's a war on Christianity is what it is. It's a war on American values. It is a war on traditional America. That is what it is. You have to look at it from 30,000 feet. The Islamic agenda, the agenda of the Council on American Islamic Relations and all its related Muslim Brotherhood terrorist groups, and they are terrorist groups, whether they act like terrorists physically in this country or not. They are all perfectly willing to engage in that kind of activity, but they find a much more effective route in the United States, which is by attacking and vilifying anyone that attempts to expose who they are. And then you have the gay lesbian activists who are targeting the heart of Christianity. As you know, that is and was the goal of the pro-abortion movement in the United States. The people at the top of these various agendas don't really care about the agendas. What they care about is destroying American foundational values, because at the heart, they are trying to deconstruct America so that they can replace it with an extreme left socialist one.
All right. My guess is
a long history.
Yep. Yes, and we're going to talk about that, Jim. Listen, this is great. James Simpson is our guest, and his new piece is called The Southern Poverty Law Center, Institution of Weaponized Hate. We're going to place that on our Facebook page so that you can read the entire thing. But when we return, we'll continue our discussion of the Southern Poverty Law Center's connection with Marxism, with Lenin's teaching, with what they're trying to do in this country right now, as Jim just alluded to in more detail. So stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Once upon a time, there was a heroic organization of lawyers who fought violent white supremacists, They sued the Ku Klux Klan nearly out of existence, winning crushing multi-million dollar jury verdicts for its victims. They also helped destroy the remaining vestiges of the Jim Crow South in the 1970s and removed legal obstacles to gender equality. But what happens when such an organization wins? When the Ku Klux Klan barely has any members left, and when legally enforced racism and sexism are nearly impossible to find, but you still have hundreds of millions of dollars in donations you need to do something with. Such is the story of the Southern Poverty Law Center, an organization that has so succeeded in pushing bigots out of the mainstream that now, over 40 years after their founding, they need to constantly find new bigots inside the mainstream to fight against. When there aren't many left, that means dangerously expanding who is called a bigot. In 2009, the SPLC decided to go after Carol Swain, an African-American political science professor at Vanderbilt. They called her an apologist for white supremacy, despite the fact that she wrote a book studying and attacking white nationalism. Why? She'd once said something nice about a film that was, though she didn't know it, made by a racist. And it just so happened a month before, she had said the SPLC was improperly attacking conservatives. No longer heroic anti-racists, the SPLC have become a political weapon, and that's dangerous. The Family Research Council, a mainstream conservative think tank that advocates for mainstream conservative views, such as traditional marriage and restrictions on abortion, was put in the same category as the Klan by the SPLC because of their Christian statements on homosexuality. The SPLC's report even inspired a mad gunman to shoot a security guard at the Family Research Council's headquarters.
All right, that was Scott Walter of Capital Research Center, another organization doing great research on the SPLC. My guest is James Simpson, who is an investigative journalist. His new article is called The Southern Poverty Law Center, Institution of Weaponized Hate. And I want to read Jim's opening here, if I might. Since the election of Donald Trump as 45th president of the United States, the leftist underground has surfaced in unprecedented, full-throated effort to neutralize his historic victory. This underground includes violent communist, socialist, and anarchist street thugs from groups like Refuse Racism, Antifa, Black Lives Matter, but it also includes many Democrat politicians, judges, and bureaucrats at all levels of government. For example, judges essentially governing from the bench with unconstitutional restraint orders, elected officials erecting sanctuary policies in direct defiance of the federal government, and media willing to give them all rhetorical cover. Running interference are groups like the American Civil Liberties Union and the Southern Poverty Law Center, who have joined the Council on American-Islamic Relations in an unholy alliance to attack and silence the left's critics. Jim, tell us, how is it that the ACLU, the SPLC, and CARE all work together? What parts and roles do they play in this mess?
Well, as I think you're aware, they all work off the same playbook, which is to attack and discredit anyone who has the temerity to even question what they're doing. You know, you don't even have to oppose it. All you have to do is question it. For example, I know of many states where state legislators have proposed, for example, legislation that attempts to flesh out the cost of refugee resettlement. I mean, you'd think that would be within their bailiwick, right, to find out what their taxpaying voters are having to spend for this federal program. They're attacked as Islamophobes and racists and bigots for even suggesting such an idea. I mean, so it has nothing to do with the targets, per se. The targets are innocent people who raise legitimate questions, but they are engaged in an unforgivable sin, and that is questioning and even, more importantly, shining a light on what the left is actually doing. And the left, in this case, in collusion with the Islamists, and they both share a common goal of watching this country fall apart.
You know, Jim,
so that they can take over in the ashes like the proverbial phoenix, rise from the ashes and take over. And they're all in a very good position to do so because most of them occupy the bureaucracy and in many cases influential positions in both of the main political parties.
Yes, and I want to emphasize again, it seems, from my perspective, it seems like they're the things of which they fan the flames and the categories upon which they list people as hate groups is generally anything that's against radical Islam, any person or group who's in favor of borders and a national sovereignty and America's mm-hmm. heritage, anything that we're called xenophobes. And then, of course, the racists, any persons that oppose anything, any excuse to use the word racism, they use it. And then, of course, bigotry and then the LGBT issue. So those are the things, those are the topics that it seems that they cover. But, Jim, this is not new. And and so I want, that's what I'd like for us to talk about next. You are really an expert on the left and the history of it. And I want to go back into that. First of all, this whole business, we need to explain that. And maybe in the last segment, I want to go into this more fully, but I just want to state that social media outlets right now are using the SPLC and their hate map to target and marginalize and erase and eradicate. This would be YouTube, it'd be Google, it would be Twitter, it would be Facebook. People that have been identified by the SPLC are in big trouble on those social media outlets, and that's why it's so relevant to our discussion right now in this country. But the word, the use of the word hate, let's talk about that. Because where did they pull that out? They call us, those of us that are on the right, we're supposedly be the haters. But why did they choose that word? And in what way do you see them using it, misusing it?
Well, first of all, it's a tactic. It is a tactic because, as Saul Alinsky said, you know, ridicule is the most powerful weapon. Nobody likes to be marginalized. I mean, we are, people are instinctively, we are social animals. We are people who thrive and really depend for our livelihood on being among the society. No man stands alone. We are all together. And so the best way to isolate and destroy opponents is to vilify them in the public sphere. And if the public sphere, in the manner of Hollywood, the media, universities, essentially the entire cultural narrative is controlled by the hard left, it's very easy to vilify people who will come forth with a message that they don't like. And the worst part of it is that most people instinctively know, or they really suspect, that when people are being vilified as haters and racists and all that, it's probably not really true. But that doesn't matter, because if you or I are vilified and we are pushed into an extremist corner and have no opportunity to defend ourselves, everybody around us is going to shy away from us simply as a survival tactic, as a way of avoiding being painted with the same brush. It has nothing to do with the facts. It is a tactic that relies on human herd instincts and fear. I call it cultural terrorism because that's what it is. And it started with Vladimir Lenin. In 1917, he said, "We must write in a language that inspires hate, revulsion, and scorn towards those who disagree with us." Not bad people, but those who disagree with us. So he was very straightforward about that. And I'll get even further into it if you'll give me a minute. Most people have never heard of a man named Willy Munzenberg. He was a German communist who, in his early 20s, went right into Lenin's inner circle because he was such an effective organizer. And in one of the early Comintern's, he said, now listen to this, because this is taken from a book called Double Lives by Stephen Koch. It's a masterful, masterful expose of the Soviets' early efforts to control the narrative. He was speaking to a Comintern packed with intellectuals. He said, "We must organize the intellectuals. The revolution needed middle-class opinion makers, artists, journalists, quote, people of goodwill, novelists, actors, playwrights, humanists, people whose innocent sensitivities weren't yet cauterized to nervelessness by the genuine white-hot radical steel." He said that we must avoid being a purely communist organization. We must bring in other names, other groups to make persecution more difficult. Middle-class opinion makers, liberal sympathizers, however much we hate them, must be used. Co-option may have stuck hard Leninists as soft, but Munzberg pointed out the powder keg was not blowing despite all kinds of sparks. So he wanted to organize the intellectuals, and he said, to make Western society stink. Only by making the West so corrupt it stinks will people be willing to just throw in the towel and allow us and allow socialism to come forward. And
Jim,
so where those ideas come from.
Yeah, let me put some context in this, because you and I are sort of steeped in this a little bit, you more than me, mm-hmm. but certainly I grew up with this understanding, the dangers. Mm-hmm. For those of you listening, could I just say that these things that we are seeing unfold in our nation, what Jim is saying is this is not new. There were people centuries ago who were sitting around thinking about how to deconstruct, and I would say more than, they could say Western values, we could say Judeo-Christian values. It would be Judeo-Christian. And they set out, they set people against each other, to use psychological methods like Jim just described, with the use of hate to marginalize, make people less than human, because generally speaking, people don't want to kill each other, but if they can dehumanize each other, it's much easier to go to that next step. And it had to do with controlling. And as you read this stuff, then you understand, oh, that's what's happening. We're seeing this happen again. It's happened many, many places on the globe since Lenin. You know, Jim, I don't know if anyone before Lenin was actually verbalizing these ideas. Were they?
Well, there was a person named Sergei Nechayev who wrote the Revolutionary Catechism in 1869. He was a 22-year-old anarchist, and he formed a group called the Nihilists, and that's the first we ever heard of it. He took as his slogan, "The ends justify the means." He's the person who popularized that among the left. And his idea was that only through a complete and total destruction of Western society could a new movement based on communism be built. And Lenin took Nechayev's Revolutionary Catechism and reproduced it everywhere. Lenin adored Nechayev. And essentially, Nechayev's Revolutionary Catechism became the blueprint for all subsequent communist revolutions, including the order of execution, which Nechayev specified in his Revolutionary Catechism. So yes, all of those ideas were actually incorporated in Nechayev's Revolutionary Catechism. And anybody who hasn't read it, most people never heard of him. I suggest you read it, because you will see that pretty much all of the left's ideas spring from that one very small, few pages long document. It's astounding. And Nechayev's group assassinated Tsar Alexander II, and Lenin's older brother tried to do exactly the same thing in the exactly the same way with Tsar Alexander III, and he was caught, tried, and executed. So there's two reasons why Lenin is particularly interested in Nechayev. One, because he inspires all communist revolutions, but also on a personal level, because his brother tried to do what Nechayev had done and failed and paid with his life for it.
And just to drive home a point about the spiritual nature of this, for those, again, coming up from a different generation, communists outlawed God in the Soviet Union, for sure. In China also, there's been some toleration, but they have tried to eradicate God and people's any kind of faith in Jesus Christ and the Judeo-Christian. They hate Jews. They've purged them. And then, of course, in Saul Alinsky, who is the American version of the modern communist, dedicated his book Rules of Radicals to the first great rebel, who was Satan. They don't hide this. And so, Jim, when we return, let's go now even further with this whole cultural revolution thing, with this controlling the narrative with hate speech, with political correctness, and so that people can understand what's actually happening before our very eyes. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Well, let me be very clear here that Floyd Corkins was responsible for the wounding of one of our colleagues and one of my friends yesterday here at the Family Research Council. But I believe he was given a license to do that by a group such as the Southern Poverty Law Center, who, as you pointed out earlier, labeled us a hate group because we defend the family and we stand for traditional Orthodox Christianity. And I'm going to interrupt, Tony, that was Tony Perkins.
And that was right after the shooting in FRC, where Floyd Corkins had read on the Southern Poverty Hate List that the FRC was standing for values, which Christian values particularly. My guest is James Simpson. Of course, his new piece is the Southern Poverty Law Center Institution of Weaponized Hate, which again we'll have on our Facebook page for you to read. And before we took the break, I was making the point that this is a deeply anti-God movement. It manifested itself, as Jim described, back before Lenin. Lenin made it most famous. Stalin carried it even further, murdering millions of his people. Hitler joined in with his own version. I know you can say that they were, yes, a lot of socialists in various forms are enemies of each other, but their basic philosophy remains the same. We see it in China. We've seen it in Vietnam. We've seen it in North Korea. And now we're seeing it raise its ugly, brutal head in the United States of America. Jim, could you say more about the really blatant anti-God overtones of this movement?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I found the exact quote for Willie Munzenberg, and he said, this is exactly to your point, our goal is to organize the intellectuals and use them to make Western civilization stink. Only then, after they have corrupted all its values and made life impossible, can we impose the dictatorship of the proletariat. Now, Munzenberg was very important. He is the person who created the Popular Front idea. He sent a Soviet agent to Hollywood to create the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League, which was really the Hollywood Pro-Communist League. And most of the communist activity was conducted through that front. And there were many fronts he established in America and throughout Europe. He was the 1920s, 30s, and 40s version of George Soros. But, of course, he fell afoul of Stalin and was ultimately murdered for all of his efforts. But he inspired what we all know now as the Frankfurt School, the Frankfurt School of Social Research in Frankfurt, Germany, which reinstituted itself at Columbia Teachers College before World War II, because the communist Jewish the professors that were teaching there had to flee Germany. And then they spread their poison throughout the American Ivy League colleges and began corrupting our students with something which they called critical theory. And the whole purpose of critical theory was simply to do what Munzenberg said, which is to criticize every single aspect of American society until Americans just frankly just no longer believe in our country. And as Munzenberg said, only then can we establish the dictatorship of the proletariat. And, you know, Lenin added to his statement, he said, there's no reason that we should be favor the First Amendment. Why should we freedom of speech and freedom of the press be allowed? Why should a government which is doing what it believes is right allow itself to be criticized? It would not allow opposition by lethal weapon. Ideas are much more fatal things than guns. So their idea was to prevent anybody from saying anything bad about them, while at the same time they could say nothing but bad things about us.
So, Jim, these Marxist Jews, intellectuals, who went to Columbia and established the Frankfurt School, which is a new term to a lot of people. The Frankfurt School is out of which the European communists developed their theories more fully, and they didn't stop after. This was separate from Russia. Russia was like the I don't know what you'd call it. It was like the playground. It was like the prototype of their ideas. Germany did not adopt communism. They threw out Hitler, who I would argue that Hitler and Stalin were closer in their philosophy than they were enemies, but they were very close actually in their philosophy. Wouldn't you say that?
Yeah, they were competitors.
Yes, there you go.
Competitors for competing versions of socialism, which really, socialism, when you boil it down to its essence, is nothing more than an excuse to confiscate private property for your own enrichment and power. That's what socialism is functionally all about.
All right, so
it's ever been about.
And just to drive home the point, Jim, of course, this is connecting dots because we do, of course, talk about this a lot. So yep. Professors then fanned out through the United States, and of course, radical communists had a stronghold in Madison, Wisconsin. They found a stronghold in Columbia. They found strongholds in Northern California, in Berkeley.
Chicago.
In Chicago, yes, my hometown. And people like Barack Obama went to Columbia and were steeped in this philosophy, as were many other people that don't have time to mention. But I do want us to talk about a few people whose names, and then those professors, in turn, radicalized their students and then radicalized other professors and then started controlling who got hired. And now our colleges and universities are producing, because the professors have subscribed to this, are producing our children, changing them, transferring them into really socialist advocates. That's the kindest thing I could say.
Yes. Yeah, that's about the kindest thing you can say.
Well, let's talk.
Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, Jim. I was just going to talk about people in particular, because Herbert Marcuse was the German communist who sort of led the Frankfurt School and came to the United States leading it. And one of his students was Angela Davis. Tell us about that little interaction.
Well, it's important because Herbert Marcuse, he was one of the Frankfurt School intellectuals, and he's responsible for a lot of the hard left's ideology. For example, he was the one to push open sexuality. He wrote a book called where he advocated something called polymorphous sexuality. The idea was to detach sexuality from any moral values. And he was called the father of the sexual revolution. And he was also called the father of the new left. He mentored Angela Davis, who was also connected very closely to Julian Bond, who was a co-founder and lifetime board member of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And Bond and Marcuse also worked with a number of radical organizations, one of which was the NCNP, the National Conference for New Politics, which the late Senator James Eastland described as working hand in glove with the Communist Party to foment revolution in the United States. Bond and Marcuse were co-founders of the Radical Journal In These Times. Bond wrote the foreword to one of Angela Davis's books, and they were both very interested in her when she was jailed for her alleged role in the Black Panther murder of a California judge. So they, the three of them actually have a lot of connections. And Bond was given the idea for going after political opponents by Herbert Marcuse, who wrote an article called Repressive Tolerance. And in it, he argued that the left would never be heard in the United States because the United States is, you know, racist, sexist, and oppressive. And so the only answer is to shut down voices that oppose the left and allow the left only to speak in public. He called that liberating tolerance. We call it partisan tolerance. And that was the idea that created the Southern Poverty Law Center's hate agenda.
All right, and so we had Julian Bond, who was the president of the NAACP. He's a contemporary. Most people probably have seen Julian on television when he was leading the NAACP. But he was also on the board for the Southern Poverty Law Center. But that brings us up to the leadership now. Mark Potok, as you mentioned earlier, is one of the spokespersons for the SPLC. What is his connection with communist organizations?
Well, he's written a lot of articles for People's World, which is the Communist Party newspaper in the United States. Southern Poverty Law Center uses an organization called Other Words to promote their various written articles, things like that. And Other Words is a project of the Institute for Policy Studies. And the Institute for Policy Studies, some have claimed, is actually a KGB front. It's an extreme leftist, the most extreme leftist, Washington, D.C. think tank. And by the way, Hillary Clinton worked for some of its leaders when she was young in the 1980s. But that think tank was set up with monies provided by Samuel Rubin, who founded Fabergé Perfumes. Samuel Rubin was a Soviet Comintern agent. And the whole story about how he founded Fabergé is a story I'd love to get into, but we don't have time. But it'll blow
you know
your
what?
Mind.
Let's. Oh my goodness. Well, we'll recommend, of course, this article. Hopefully, you'll do a follow up on it, Jim, with that story. But let's bring this thing around. The SPLC. Sure. We started out by talking that they have apologized about adding or including a former Muslim terrorist or extremist. On their hate list, and they've paid him $3.3 million, which is a pretty stunning story because nobody seems to ever have won anything against the Southern Poverty Law Center, nor have they admitted. I don't think they even ever apologized for having the hate list, which caused Floyd Corkin to go in and try to commit mass murder in FRC. But as it stands, Jim, the SPLC rose to such heights that the FBI, the Department of Defense, was using them as their arbiter. And now we have Facebook, Twitter, Google, all using the SPLC as their arbiter of what constitutes hate. I'd like your thoughts about that so that we can wrap up here. That's how dangerous it still is, right?
Well, to me, that represents just how far the hard left has infiltrated into all of our various institutions. You know, I mean, even Facebook.
Mark Zuckerberg
said in his testimony before Congress that, you know, all of his fact checkers are California liberals, so don't expect too much out of them. That was the implication. And the fact that they used the SPLC is just more confirmation that this entire thing, it's a network of leftists who are all on the same page. And they have to be brought to task for that. It has to be recognized in the public sphere that this is not a typical nonprofit organization. They have a $500 million, by the way, in assets. So $3 million is a hiccup to them. It's nothing. But they should be tried and investigated under RICO statutes as a continuing criminal enterprise and have all of their assets seized. That would be a wake-up call to all the other leftist organizations that uncritically use their information, because it is a network that is spread throughout the United States.
Yes.
And I have seen it myself countless times where I have been slammed in press reports because I have been identified as associating with anti-Muslim extremists.
Yes, I know. Me too, Jim. You know, I'm on that Women Against Islam list that they printed with my likeness and location. It's a Southern Poverty Law Center institution of weaponized hate. The article will be on our Facebook. James Simpson has been our guest. This has been Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.